I wondered right off the bat about pre-K in general. Are there numbers out there that say this is really a good thing widespread and that this is something that Indiana should consider quickly moving from kind of pilot stage, as long as it works, into something that would be more statewide?
Well, the data are clear that our neighbors who come from lower-income households with lower levels of education often start as many as two grades behind their middle-income peers when they enter kindergarten. And that's a gap that even as our lower-income neighbors improve academically, they don't improve as fast. And not only do they not catch up to their middle-income peers, that gap widens from one grade to the next. And so that when people talk about the need for, you know, pre-K education for students, especially our lower income neighbors, those are the data that they point to, is that gap and trying to close that gap before those students arrive in kindergarten.
So a number of these pilots are happening in largely urban counties like Allen County and places like that. Do you think that it needs to be proven there to try to address some of the more populous low-income areas of the state, and then it'll trickle down to all of the rest of the state?
Well, the approach that the state is taking is let's run our own program and let's measure for ourselves. And so that's why there's this so-called pilot, not a full, you know, statewide expansion, but a pilot in these five locations with rigorous measurement attached to that implementation. The challenge, of course, is that we won't know the real results for about 20 years. You know, when we see, are these students more likely to graduate from high school? Are they more likely to earn post-secondary education? And are they more likely to be employed supporting themselves? That's the hope. And some other research indicates that you're greatly increasing the odds that those students will enjoy that success. But state government in Indiana has decided we'll do our own research and measure our particular program.
So even once we get to the end of the pilot stage, if they decide to go forward, it will be with only partial results, is what you're saying.
Well, on the one hand, there's going to be this pilot program and there will be the data from this pilot program. On the other hand, of course, always comes in the budget, regardless of what the data say, political ideology, regardless of what the data say. And the legislators that we have spoken to on both sides of the aisle, especially on the Republican side of the aisle, the concern really isn't always so much about the data and the impact. It's from their perspective, can the state pay for this for the long term? That perhaps there's money now as the economy is improving, but the state has this surplus. But what about 5 years from now? And what about 10 years from now? And certainly there are well-intended people who disagree with that viewpoint. And that's where the political disagreement comes in down at the state house. People who say, well, let's tap into the surplus or let's raise taxes to pay for this. So it's going to be interesting to watch how this pilot phase is implemented, how it rolls out. Certainly, the state's going to measure to determine the impact on these children. Initially, of course, in the short term, we won't know, you know, the longest result until, like I said, 20 years from now. And then there's always that budget reality of people saying, even if this is a good thing, can we pay for it for the long term? That's, I think, going to be where the bigger question lies moving forward.
So how does the Indiana Youth Institute figure into this discussion? How are you going about interacting with lawmakers as the discussion happens?
Yeah, well, at IYI, we have a very unique role in that. We're Switzerland. We're neutral. We don't take sides. And it's because we provide data. We can present data by the state, by county, by school district, by zip code, by census tract. And we have friends who are Republicans and we have friends who are Democrats, and we like to provide that data to our friends. And so what we like to do is find the research on early childhood education and present that to legislators, present information in other states and present that to legislators, and let them decide what they think is best. You know, other examples, we didn't say yes or no to school vouchers. We didn't say yes or no to charter schools. That's not our role. Our role is to be that neutral provider of information. And because of that, we find we're able to bring Republicans and Democrats together. One of my favorite stories with IYI is we had an event about 3 years ago where we were encouraging people to mentor children to help them succeed academically. And we had then Superintendent of Public Instruction Tony Bennett sitting right next to the head of the Indiana State Teachers Association, Nate Schnellenberger, who couldn't agree on the day of the week or what the name of the month was, but both came together to promote mentoring. That's our role at IYI, is to do our best to bring people together. There are lots of other folks, you know, putting up their signs and signing their petitions to get a particular viewpoint passed.
The state has, of course, talked about pre-K. We've talked about having full-day kindergarten throughout the state. And we've talked about having better metrics to measure the kids who are already in school. is it your opinion that the state is going broadly in the right direction, or does it need to kind of ramp up its efforts, especially at the early education, which has been so much talked about in the last few years?
Yeah, it's very complex. I mean, when you talk about early education, we have the early childhood education. We have full-day kindergarten, which is not fully funded. School districts only funded at half the cost of a student. They have to find the rest of the money somewhere else, either with their own local dollars. There are some state grants. Districts with high levels of poverty can use some federal money, but the state does not fully fund those kindergarten kids yet. How about the age when you start? You can wait till you're 7 years old to start school in the state of Indiana. There are a lot of folks who feel it's kind of odd that we're spending all this time talking about early childhood education and somebody can still show up as a seven-year-old for the first time at school. There's a very open question about textbooks. Indiana is one of the few states in the country that charges parents for the use of textbooks. And unlike Purdue University, where you buy them and you get to keep them if you want to, for your local school district, you rent them and you have to give them back. So people say, wait a minute, if we're so focused on kids' education, why do we have to pay for these textbooks? There's another line of thought out there. You know, down in Tennessee, they just are now providing that every resident of Tennessee can have 2 years of post-secondary education paid for by the state. Your president of the university here, when he was governor, Mitch Daniels, actually proposed that for Indiana. They were going to rent out the lottery and use the proceeds to provide 2 years of post-secondary for every resident. It wasn't able to pass. It's going to be really interesting to watch in Indiana and other states. Are people going to follow Tennessee's example, not just on early childhood education, but since 2/3 of the jobs require post-secondary education, should a state like Indiana provide money for everybody to get at least 2 years at an Ivy Tech or a Vincennes or an associate's from Purdue? So it's hard to look at early childhood just in and of itself. It really, truly is part of this broader, complex weave and tapestry of many issues swirling around education. We also need to point out more than half of Indiana's budget every year is spent on education. It's one of the highest percentages in the country. And so there are folks who say we still need more money. Others say, you know what, we're spending more money than other states. It's how it's being spent. That's where the disagreements often come in.
So when you're having conversations with your friends, as you put it, in the legislature about that issue of how much are we spending on education, what are they telling you? How are they reading the tea leaves about how that's going to progress?
Well, I'll tell you, as we get set for the General Assembly, it's going to be really interesting to watch. On the one hand, you have the Democrats in the State House who are advocating for the traditional public schools, especially those with high levels of poverty, which is where a lot of the Democrats are elected from the cities and pockets of our high numbers of our low-income neighbors. Then you have on the Republican side supporters of traditional public schools, but they're being asked to provide more funding for the growing school districts that have seen their per-student money go down in the last couple of budgets. So there you have that happening. And then the governor comes out and says, I want fairness and equality in education, therefore more money for vouchers and charters. So you sort of have these three viewpoints now in the General Assembly, the Democrats with traditional public schools, especially those serving high numbers of low-income kids, Republicans talking about traditional public schools, especially those that are growing with high numbers of middle class kids, and then the governor with his agenda, which emphasizes vouchers and charters, all at a time when the state budget is not meeting its expectations, will likely finish in a deficit this year. It's going to be very interesting to watch how that plays out.
What do the data that you see from the different organizations say is the best way to go? Should the state pick one of those three directions? Should it adopt a hybrid approach that tries to bring in as many of those as possible? Do we have enough data to tell us that?
You know, I promise I'm not trying to dodge the question. It truly is, we do not take sides in those debates. I mean, we want to provide information and data. Here's what we say to all of that. For your listeners, wherever they come down on these issues, get involved. Use our data and contact Representative Klinker. Use our data, contact the governor's office. And because our data are neutral, they're very reliable. There is no hidden agenda with us. Legislators will tell you, don't send them a form letter that everybody signs. Don't send them a petition that everybody signs. As many as 25 phone calls or as many as 25 differently written letters can swing a discussion down at the State House. That's what we encourage people to do, is get the information, get involved. Even a small number of people can move the needle down at the General Assembly.
Are people writing letters to IYI saying we think that we're seeing success with approach A or approach B? I mean, what are you hearing from people out in the state?
And again, we're hearing from all sides. I mean, I was in a high poverty urban district a couple of weeks ago and heard that viewpoint. I was in a growing suburban middle class district last week, heard their kind of different viewpoint on the story. And we serve people who are big champions of vouchers and charters, and they're all heading to the General Assembly this year to request, you know, funding for their particular priority. Again, the other key issue here is to watch the budget. Indiana's economy, like the nation's economy, is getting better. More people are being employed. But right now, the state budget is running behind projection. It will finish in a deficit at its current rate. Now, the governor says that he won't let that happen. He'll make other cuts and rescissions before the end of the fiscal year. But if projected revenues grow, and there'll be a budget announcement in December and then another one in April. If projected budget revenues grow by only 1.5 to 2%, that's basically a break-even budget, because now all you've paid for is inflation and there will be no new money. So unless there will be a tax increase, not going to happen. Unless they dip into the surplus, not going to happen. It's going to be, how do we allocate the current dollars that we have? And that's going to be where the push and pull is between the traditional public schools serving high numbers of our children who are low income, our other traditional schools who serve high numbers of middle class kids that are growing, and the folks who are advocating for vouchers and charters. We're probably going to have basically the same amount of money. It's going to be how we're going to divide up the pie.
So getting back to what you started with, I think one of the things that education watchers get back to from time to time is we still have an education gap. We have some people who have ready access to it, some people who are more able to take advantage of educational opportunities, and some people for whom there are many, many more barriers to an education. And it seems like this is one of the things that you and the state are working on, is how do we close the gap? Are we doing better at that?
Harvard University has a wonderful program called the Equality of Opportunity Project. And they studied millions of children over 30 years. And what they found is that economic opportunity is still alive and well in the country. In fact, the ability to move up the economic ladder is as strong, if not better, today than it was in 1971, according to the study from Harvard. But then why do we still see the persistence of poverty? Why do we still see people not climbing that economic ladder? And they pointed to six factors. One is segregation, not just by race, but by income. And by segregation, then, what happens is a lack of access to transportation, a lack of proximity to jobs, but also a lack of seeing employment and seeing success and then believing that it can be for you. Family formation is huge. When you have a higher percentage of single-parent families, you have a very likely a higher percentage of children living in poverty who will then stay in poverty over time. The percentage of caring adults who volunteer and help out, Robert Putnam social capital, if you will, where there are higher percentages of engaged organizations, faith-based congregations, Boys and Girls Clubs, Bauer Centers, you're likely to break cycles of poverty and help people move up. But by far, the Harvard people also point out the quality of education and educational availability and educational opportunity, early childhood, K through 12, and post-secondary. When you look at all of those things, family formation by far is the most difficult. This is so personal and it's so intimate and it's so hard to say, hey, here's how you should form your family. It's very difficult in today's society and culture to do that. What the Harvard people say is where we have the greatest control is in education. We spend a lot of money there. Those are the buttons we can push and the levers that we can pull to have an impact. The other area is the social capital area. At IYI, what we say is, if you're a parent, please raise your kids. And whether you're a parent or not, please volunteer in your community. Call Rhonda McGinnis at Big Brothers Big Sisters. Call the Bauer Center. Be involved at First Baptist or through your local congregation if that's part of your life. Be engaged through your civic organization. Down in Lebanon, the Kiwanis Club partnered with the school and the mayor to start a mentoring program. When we can get more caring adults into the lives of kids, let the policymakers take care of the systems. As voters, let's be involved with our policymakers. But in the meantime, what can we do every day? Raise our kids and volunteer to mentor others.
So it sounds broadly, to try to put a bow on this, that when we're talking about education, we should think about not just what goes on at the state house, and in fact, not just what goes on in the schoolhouse, but indeed what goes on at your house and my house.
There's great research from a woman by the name of Carolyn Dweck over in Stanford, and she talks about a fixed mindset and a growth mindset. And a fixed mindset is fatalism. This is the hand I've been dealt. There's nothing I can do about it. why should I even try? Growth mindset says, maybe I've been dealt a good hand, but even not, I'm going to change things. I'm going to apply myself. I can climb up. I can do more. I can do better. And her research shows that for many of our students who are low income, they're in that fixed mindset. They don't see success. They think possibility and opportunity are for somebody else. The kids who live on the other side of town, the kids with a different skin color than mine, a kid who, you know, they have two parents, I only have one, or I have two, but you should see how my dad mistreats my mom and so forth. Therefore, success is not for me. The key is to help those kids, and it's not easy. But through our teachers, through other community influences, help those kids see a different reality by getting them to a growth mindset. You do it incrementally. You help them see small progress in their life. You help them tell stories about that progress. It can move them in that direction of growth. And again, it's not simplistic. It's not easy. And still, kids need food. They need shelter. Their parents need a job. They need access to health care. All those physical things are needed. But it's this intangible piece. It's not just the physical deprivation of poverty. It's the emotional deprivation that poverty brings, the utter hopelessness. And that's where parents and community members and mentors can make a difference while we pay attention and be involved with the very important public policy discussions at the State House.